Joe's end of Master and Commander.
Dom's end of Master and Commander. Who is the master and who's the commander? We're going to go straight. Oh, hang on. The phone's ringing. Hello.
Hello. Is that Rusty Crow? Oh, sorry. Is that Russell? Mr. Russell Crow?
No, no, mate. You can call me Rusty. I don't mind it.
You don't mind? Oh, terrific.
No,
oh,
no, of course, really mate. Call me Rusty. Cool. Yeah, no, no. Rusty.
Oh, great.
Russell. Rass. The Crow Dog. The Crow Road. Big Dog.
The crow dog, I like that.
The only thing you can't call me is Cameron Crow. That's the one thing I draw a line at that. Jason Lee at an awards party, he called me, he's frozen. He called me Cameron Crow and I didn't take kindly to it. Anyway, what can I do you for, bud?
And the Oscar goes to Cameron Crow for Almost Famous.
First Academy Award and third nomination for Cameron Crowe. In 1996, he was a double nominee for Best Picture and Original Screenplay for Jerry Maguire.
Oh, man.
Hi, everybody. I'm Cameron.
Welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond.
Hi.
And I'm joined as ever by, there he is, it's the old Leaky Bucket Boy. He watches films and then forgets about them. That's the nub of it. And it's
the rub.
It's the nub. It's not the rub.
It's the rub as well as the nub, I would say.
No, it's not the rub of you. That doesn't make any sense.
Why can't it be the rub as well as the nub?
Well, because the nub is the heart of you, and the rub, it's like the rub of the green.
Yeah.
That's which way it goes, but...
Yeah. That's the which way it goes of me. Does that, you think that doesn't make sense?
It doesn't. I mean, the rub of you is you in a chair eating B&J and slopping it on your chin and your tummy, and then you just starting to caress it into your folds. That's the rub of you.
That is so disgusting. Well, the rub of you.
This is the show where we chat about the movies or films that we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. Now it's the second week running. We're on week two of Joe, No Brother, Where Art Thou?
I've nearly, though. I've got, like, significant movement in my finding a new home process. In my moving into a new home process, which does mean we're closer than ever to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? But, yeah, you're right. This week it still is No Brother, Where Art Thou?
So that'll be fun when we finally get to it, because I'm not rewatching it. So there'll be quite a distance.
You'll have forgotten by then. Yeah, it's going to be a while.
I don't want to get into my response to it, but I wouldn't have forgotten. I'm not a leaky bucket. And even if I was, I would pretend that I wasn't.
Right, because that's your character.
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, but it's good that you've got that. That's the nub of you. You know your character to a T.
So we're doing, for some reason, because it was floating around the communal list toilet bowl, and it was a toilet bowl, guys, let's be honest. Master and Commander was splashing about, and Joe was really apologetic. He said, oh god, I'm so sorry, Adam, I'm so sorry, I haven't got to see this film, No Brother, Where Art Thou? Oh, what should we do? And I said, I don't know, mate. I was actually getting a bit annoyed, if I'll be honest. Joe doesn't realize this. I was getting a bit fucking annoyed. He's broken the format. And I just, like, make a decision, tell me what to watch, and we'll talk about it. So he said, oh, Master and Commander? And I said, fine, I've never seen it before.
Had you never seen it before?
Never seen it before. I've got no...
Really?
I never would put this on, ever. So, great. Give me a reason to watch this flick. Hmm. So I did. And that's what we're doing. That's what we're chatting about.
Yeah. It sounds like I'm kind of a hero, to be honest, for format breaking. You know, I'm the kind of guy that doesn't squeeze into a mode, you know, breaks free of chains and shackles. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm a shackle breaker.
Yeah, you're Shackleton. So this is the 2003 Peter Weir
director. Peter Weir director.
That's
this one.
That's actually how you say his name.
Peter Weir.
He's from
the northeast, presumably.
He's Dutch. Peter Weir.
Peter Weir. Oh, Peter Weir.
It's Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. That's the full title because they thought, yeah. We'll do a few of these. We want to do Master and Commander, :
The Near Side of the World.
Or Over the Moon. Or
I wonder what it was called in Brazil because it was local to them, wasn't it?
That's a deep cut. Here's the letterbox. Of course, it stars Rusty Crowe. We've already spoken to him. Also features Dr. Paul Bettany, David Threffel, of course, it's Eagles! Billy Eagles, Boyd! Yeah.
Plus, it's got, I'm pretty certain, I didn't fact check this or look this up, but the young officer that gets taken against by the crew and grabs a cannonball and jumps into the ocean, I believe that he plays one of the characters, the conductor on the special magical bus in the third Harry Potter film. Yeah. I believe that's him. Mm. Sirius Black. That guy.
Lee Ingleby.
Not Sirius Black, but is it him?
Azkaban. Well done.
Perfect, thank you.
So it's a horribly soggy 138 mins.
It is a little soggy, and not just because it's set in the ocean.
The courage to do the impossible lies in the hearts of men. After an abrupt and violent encounter with a French warship inflicts severe damage upon his ship, a captain, Rusty Crowe, of the British Royal Navy, begins a chase over two oceans to capture or destroy the enemy, though he must weigh his commitment to duty and ferocious pursuit of glory against the safety of his devoted crew, including the ship's thoughtful surgeon, his best friend, Dr. Paul Bettany. Lovely to see these two together. Anytime. It's a dangerous mind.
Oh,
it's a beautiful mind. It's Master and Commander. And so you'd seen this before. I hadn't seen it before. Tell me about your thoughts and reflections of seeing it first time round and then jump ahead to now.
Almost none. Like deep, deep annals of time. You know, I have a vague memory of wishing that it were another Gladiator and knowing that it wasn't another Gladiator in my teenage mindset. But I genuinely hadn't watched it for, I'm going to say, 20 years. I did have it on video at some point, I think. So I believe that's how far back we're going. But I thought it wasn't very good. Then I wondered, ahead of a rewatch, were there misunderstandings involved here? Was I simply a teenager who was expecting some kind of action-packed, fun-fueled ancient Roman fair, and instead I got something different that I thought was shit, but actually it's just because I was a teenager and I didn't understand it, you know? Anyway, I think that's 25% the case and 75% not the case upon my rewatch.
I mean, it's not a shit film, let's be honest.
No, not at all.
Not a shit film at all.
Not a shit film. Quite a confusing film. Very soggy. Soggy's the word.
Well, it's interesting. I'm going to say interesting a lot. The word that Daddy Mortensen says you're not supposed to say in Captain Fantastic.
The nothing person word, I think, isn't it?
But this is interesting because this film, it kind of feels like it shouldn't have been made or exist.
Yeah.
They would have spent serious amount of money on it.
Yeah.
It's got Rusty Crowe in. Obviously, that's why it got made. But there's no real story in it at all.
There's really not a lot of action either.
It opens with a big battle, ends with a big battle. Great.
Yeah.
But in the middle, you've got about 100 mins, at least.
You've got an expanse of two oceans and not a lot to do.
And the whiff of the story is, we're going to hunt this ship down. And then in between, it's kind of a series of anecdotes and side stories, side missions.
Yeah.
Which is like, that's really not usual. So that's kind of cool. I did a little digging. Apparently, they took a lot of these different stories from... There's loads of these books. And Peter Weir, just he kind of wanted to keep that vibe. He wanted to get a sense of the world as opposed to tell a story. And he does that, you know. Sometimes it's more interesting. And sometimes it's quite boring.
That's true, yeah.
Cannonball Suicide is a real gut punch, is a real surprise.
Sure.
And so you're like, oh, I haven't seen that. That's quite dark.
Oh, Cannonball Suicide.
Yeah, and then other times you're like, oh, I wish this was a bit more Hollywood. I wish this had a bit more of a trad story. And then that made me feel like maybe that reflected poorly on me.
No, I don't think so. Because I think, like you said, the downside of the film, the upside is it's interesting, it's unusual. The downside is that big chunks of it are quite boring. And, you know, when you say you wish, you know, part of you wished it had a more trad story, part of me wished that I could pause it and have some knowledge of where I was in the film. Like, that's what I mean. Well, that's what I hear when you say, I wish it had a bit more of a trad story. A little bit more familiarity, not predictability, but a little bit of familiarity would have helped. Because, like you said, it's sort of, it's really a film of musings. And some of those musings I enjoyed more than others. So, for example, I like what fruit comes of the Galapagos Isles, of the surgeon doctor character, also being something of a naturalist, being a kind of like a Charles Darwin-esque character, curious to discover these new beetle species and you know, and really wants to find the flightless condor, right? Like, that's kind of fun. That's, or the cormorant, sorry, not a condor. Condor, flightless condor with tiny little wings. A cormorant. However, I also found it like slightly boringly stereotypical that one of the English men on a boat overseas in a sort of colonial age film was also a scientist and was also in the vein of Darwin. And it's a very like repeat, rinse and repeat character that I think is essentially a cliche of like commentary of the time. So that's a little bit boring. I also think that Rusty Crowe's musings of whether to follow into battle or not, how he nearly cries when he talks about, was it Nelson? Yeah, like and serving under Nelson and like the wonder of being British. And I don't know, some of that, like, I feel is interesting, considered reflection. Some of it is just, I don't know, out of time and like really doesn't stand up to today's standards, I suppose, or expectations. And so I found it bizarre, and I really couldn't work out. I thought, part of me thought, there's a 5% chance that this is a masterpiece that I'm missing, like I'm just not getting, and I definitely wouldn't have got it as a kid. But what's, I think one of the reasons it is presumably considered a failure in some ways is really completely out of its control, that it is proximal in terms of time to Proximo and Gladiator, and it's got Rusty Crowe in it, and it's a historical epic. And I know what I expected as a teenager. I expect many other people expected the same kind of thing, and it's a completely different film. It's not even in the same classification category, I would say. So part of the problem with the film is just what I think most people would have expected when coming to it in the first instance, whereas you've seen it at a time very, very divorced from Gladiator. And also not really a huge Gladiator fan or anything. So I wonder if you had a very different experience of this film than people would have at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I vastly prefer this to Gladiator. It's a lot better a film. Unfortunately, it would have been even further away if you hadn't made me rewatch Gladiator earlier this year. It feels like a million years ago, but also yesterday, where you forced me to watch Gladiator, rewatch Gladiator, and then go to the cinema to watch Gladiator 2. Uh-huh. But this is
where I forced you to do those things.
Yeah,
where I put a little leash around your neck, and I said, "Come on, doggy, come on, watch the film, watch Daddy's film."
But this is far more interesting and grown up a film than Gladiator. Yes, Rusty Crowe's got the same silly accent, but what I did appreciate about it was the details of the world, and then it doesn't paint these guys, these British colonial navy men, in a particularly nice light. you know, it, I mean, maybe not as they were, but for example, they're all getting drunk and around the table whilst and having lovely food whilst the men below decks eat slop. Yeah. Yeah. And then one of them makes a toast to wives and sweethearts. May they never meet.
That's Rusty Crowe that makes that toast.
Yeah, so you're like, and he, so in both, you know, you both see him looking at a photo of his wife and then also make that joke. And I'm like, yeah, I get that. I like you because, you know, he obviously sleeps around as well.
You'd make a version of that joke to me without the sleeping around part. Like, your version of that joke would be a more modern one. Like, you'd be something like, "Hey, look at those tits." It'd be something like that. And there wouldn't be actually any breasts in sight. You would just be saying it randomly when it was just the two of us and there was no one else there. But you wouldn't actually go and look at those tits.
Yeah, I don't know. You've gone very crass there.
I thought something better would come to me if I just started talking.
Just, we'll cut that and just try again with anything
else. Let me do it again. Yeah, it's a bit like you would do that sort of thing, wouldn't you? You would, you'd tell the more modern day version of that joke, for example, if it was just you and I and we'd gone out and, you'd say, you know, I'd love me a go on.
I wouldn't say I'd love me a go on anything. I would say, oh.
On that arcade machine.
Crumbs. You know,
crumbs.
I'd say crumbs.
Dithers.
Lucky I've got a VPN at home.
Oh, stop talking about your VPN. Jesus Christ. Any opportunity. My God.
But yeah, what had dated for me, as opposed to the sexism, which was fine,
yeah,
was Rusty Crowe's character, his obsession with leadership, strength, and respect. And he says men must be governed.
Yes.
Now, I think back then, you could kind of make an argument for...
When you say back then, do you mean in the times the film was set or in 2002?
Both. 2003.
Yeah.
I can imagine, you know, this is post 9/11. If there's not more a 9/11 movie than Master and Commander Far Side of the World, I'd like to see it because we are staring down the barrel of a film that is wrestling with the big 9/11 questions. No, but seriously.
That's true. There's a burgeoning threat that you never see, Napoleon, right? And you know that he's trundling closer and closer. You know that the threat has never been greater. You know that the enemy can come out of nowhere, can take you by surprise, can do things that you weren't expecting. So there's more and more. Now you've mentioned it. Now you say it. Master and Commander actually is quite the 9/11 homage. Not homage, but what's the correct word?
9/11
exploration.
You had it with homage. In the books, the baddies are American.
Really?
Yeah, and I feel like it's...
That makes sense, I guess.
It's a bit gross that they just went, oh yeah, everyone hates the French, let's make it the French. That's my only problem with the film.
Everyone hates Napoleon, you know?
Well, what about in the movie Napoleon? Do they hate Napoleon in that?
Yeah, pretty much. By the end, pretty much, yeah. Because he's kind of a dick, Napoleon. I don't know how much you know about Napoleon. But pretty much a dick, that guy.
Yeah, but isn't like that's just the history was written by the victors, right? Maybe he wasn't a dick. It's just because do the French think Napoleon is a dick?
I think he probably, yes, I think many of them do. I think he probably was a dick, but you're right. You're right that history is written by the victor, and maybe he was a dick in a more mild way. Or maybe he was... because eventually everyone from history is a loser, right? Even if you're a winner, because you eventually die and your power falls beyond your reach. You know, Queen Victoria, for example, could do no longer do the work of ensuring that people wrote about her in a particular way. She was a real victor in her lifetime. But now we know that she was a smelly old wench that only bathed once a year, you know. So I wonder if that could be the same with Mr. Napoleon, you know. He was really Italian, anyway.
Well, you know what they say, you either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Become a smelly old wench.
A long time ago, I was in Burma. My friends and I were working for the local government. They were trying to buy the loyalty of tribal leaders by bribing them with precious stones. But their caravans were being raided in a forest north of Rangoon by a bandit. So we went looking for the stones. But in 6 months, we never met anyone who traded with him. One day, I saw a child playing with a ruby the size of a tangerine. The bandit had been throwing it away.
So why steal it?
Well, because he thought it was good sport, because some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.
I don't think this is a post 9/11 homage like what you think. Do you know what genre of movie I think this actually is?
What?
This is a sports movie.
Oh, no.
I genuinely think this is a sports movie.
Really?
In the same way that... but I don't think that in a bad way. Because if you think about it, the opening is the ship.
Yeah.
Battered, beaten.
Absolutely,
rubbish.
Yeah, totally bettered, right?
Bettered by this other, better, bigger ship that can do things. And then the whole fat middle, soggy middle, is about them figuring out the bigger, better ship, faster ship's way of how it does and how it moves.
Yeah.
They've got to do a training montage, a.k.a. fix the ship.
Yeah.
And then someone's got to go, oh, we figured out their weakness.
It's Space Jam.
I think it's more... Space Jam or Rocky?
Well, yeah, but like Rocky doesn't lose the fight at the beginning and then win the fight at the end, you know? Whereas Space
it's the other
Jam...
Way, it's reverse, isn't
yeah.
it?
Space Jam actually...
I haven't seen Space Jam and I just thought by you saying Space Jam makes me feel like you're making fun of my thing.
No, I'm not making fun of your thing.
Okay.
In the film Space Jam, and I'm talking specifically about the Michael Jordan version of Space Jam, not the LeBron James version because I haven't seen that. But in the Michael Jordan version of Space Jam, here's what happens, okay? The Looney Tunes are challenged to a game of basketball by these little alien characters that they come along and they think they've got a little theme park off-world that's not making any money. None of the kids want to come there anymore, the alien kids, because they've got shit attractions. And so they think, what do we need in our theme park to get more people to come? Oh, tell you what, we need the Looney Tunes. So we'll go and get the Looney Tunes. Now, in order to get the Looney Tunes, they have to win a bet with the Looney Tunes. And the bet is that they will win at a game of basketball because they're tiny little aliens, you see. And on account of their short size and stature, the Looney Tunes laugh at the notion that they will lose a game of basketball. But the aliens, they come to the real human world and they suck the talent of the NBA players of the time. And then they grow in size and scale and they go back to Looney Tunes land and they beat the shit out of the Looney Tunes. And this is very near the beginning of the film. Then the Looney Tunes, these are the good characters again. I'm just going to keep going.
Absolutely.
Oh, sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I was going to say, I like the fact that you just had to flag in after that 10-minute explanation of Looney Tunes Space Jam. It felt like you'd got to the midpoint of the movie, but you realised for your argument to work that this would have to happen at the beginning of the movie.
That's kind of true.
This happens at the beginning of the movie, lest we forget.
I'd say it happens at the sort of 25% mark, you know, which is still near enough the beginning, you know.
Sure,
a little bit of exposition there to get things started, the setup and some character work, you know. Anyway, they realize and they go, oh, we're going to need somebody else to help us to join our team. So who do they go? They go and get Michael Jordan, who at the time was in Looney Tune Land, was playing baseball, professional baseball. Did you know that he did that in his career, by the way?
Yeah, I've seen, I mean, I knew at the time, and then also I've watched The Last Dance.
I was all into
Michael Jordan.
He was very much my guy. He was your guy when you were a child?
Yeah, when I was 10 years old. It was all about Air Jordan.
Really?
Michael Jordan. Yeah, absolutely.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
This isn't a weird bit you're doing?
No.
I've never heard about this part of you before.
NBA Jam, Stand Up Late, Watch Channel 4, the NBA.
Wow. Anyway, Michael Jordan helps the Looney Tunes beat the guys again at the game at the end because they spend the soggy middle working out how to do it and what's the thing. And it doesn't really work at all. Bill Murray's there, you know. He does his ankle.
Bill Murray. The pristine Bill Murray, who's never done anything wrong in his life. We all love Bill Murray, don't we?
Oh,
Bill Murray pops up in Space Jam and who gave a cast member an unwanted kiss. Ooh, Bill Murray, who whispered in Scarlett Johansson's ear something perverted and disgusting.
No doubt.
Ooh, Bill Murray.
Oh, my God. You
calm
down.
Absolutely love ragging on Bill.
Just because people like Bill Murray, you love
ragging on Bill. Yeah,
they
need to take a long, hard look at themselves.
Oh, my God. You can tell it's coming with these people because people loved Bill Murray from the year 2005 all the way through until about 2015, and then it went cool. Then it went cool, and the strength of people's adoration, you could just tell the fall was coming because it's human nature. It always does.
He hasn't had it.
It's happening. It's happening. It's going to happen.
It hasn't happened.
It's going to happen.
Well, it should.
Amongst the cohort of people like you.
I tell you what is funny. I was listening back to last week's episode where we talked about Potter and also about the Wallace of Ballad Island.
Yeah.
And in an episode where we talk about a really good film, The Wallace of Ballad Island, you and me are like, oh, Tom Basden. Oh, he worked with Ricky Gervais. Oh, fuck, man, forget it. And then later on, we talk about the cast of Harry Potter TV series. Just that's it, and we don't say anything else. And I just thought, oh, yeah, you know, some things are just too big to talk about.
Well, my friend listener to the show sent in a message about this very thing, Adam.
Yeah, no one. Yeah, you said it to me.
Well, he made some good points. He basically said, he was surprised that we didn't offer even a milk toast acknowledgement of the broader situation with J.K. Rowling and the ongoing, you know. And my response to him was to say, I never knew milk toast was spelt like that.
With a Q.
Yeah,
like a kind of a, like maybe a Spanish footballer.
Yeah.
Milquetoste.
I always assumed milk toast was just, I thought it was a weird word, but I thought that it was like, it made sense in my head because I thought, well, milk and toast are like the blandest thing. And you put them together, if you had toast that was sort of made out of milk, maybe it's a type of food I don't know about, but it would be like really bland and really kind of, you know. So I just always assumed that's what milk toast was. But
can I tell you something?
Yeah.
Milk toast. Whenever I go on my VPN, that's what I Google.
Fuck's sake. Can you stop talking about your VPN?
Anything off the trolley, dears?
this film is very admirable. It's amazing it exists. I think.
Do you mean admiral? Because I know it's a sea-based film.
Yeah, no, it's admiral and admirable.
Right.
The series of books written by Patrick O'Brien are very well loved. There are loads of them, and I think they quite like the film because it feels quite respectful and brings that world to life.
Are they? Can I ask a question about the books? Are they sort of military friendly? Are they kind of, you know, do you remember those Biggleswade ones? You know, like the pilot Biggleswade, nicknamed Biggles. It's a fictional pilot and adventurer. These Biggles books, they didn't necessarily champion like the age of colonialism, but they didn't deconstruct it in any way. They were to be read by young people. Those books were in some ways a gateway to careers in the military. You know, that's what I suppose I'm wondering about these books. Were they written for young boys, basically, who might have an interest in joining the military at some point, or are they completely separate from that and they're not part of that ecosystem?
I don't believe they are. They're quite grown up, dense,
right?
Naval. It's about the
for people that had an interest in naval history.
Yeah.
And when were they published?
I guess like the 80s and
right. Yeah. So they're not older. Okay.
They're quite old, but like not old old.
Not old old. Not Biggles old.
But like to expect that they would deconstruct colonialism or does it stuff in the past, the fact that it didn't do that, it doesn't mean it's a write off, right?
No, I just meant more that I suppose that they're not like simple heroic tales that are in some way used or intended to encourage people's military fondness, you know, or a kind of I guess I think about like that my grandfather was in the RAF and
69 70
so my grandfather was in the RAF and he went 69
yeah, dirty old man.
Dirty old granddad in the RAF. Anyway, he was in the RAF and sometimes I think about the kind of the enormous difference between the life that he grew up leading as a child. Yeah. He was born in 1937, so he would have grown up in the 40s, and obviously there were a war, you know, and then there was the post-war period, and there was a broken, rebuilt Britain, and there would have been the vestiges of this attitude towards the military, which probably would have included almost everybody that you knew, right? Like every man was conscripted. Almost virtually every man of fighting age was conscripted during the Second World War. So if you were growing up in the 40s and the 50s and you were surrounded by this environment where everyone of, you know, considered societal value had served, and it was something that every politician, every new prime minister, everyone had this respect and awe for the military. He went into it, and as a child, presumably also reading these books like Biggles, I imagine that he did. He would have gone into the military believing the value of it based on his environment at the time. Whereas I grew up in a world where, you know, a million people marched against Iraq, and where there was a very, very different attitude towards the military and the service. And so I have a very different attitude towards it myself. I don't know. I'm kind of, that's why I ask, because I'm interested in what these stories offer to their audience at the time. But thick books from the 80s, I think that is a little different, right? Yeah, it's more like reflective than it is progressive, productive.
Well, he was born in 1914, Patrick O'Brien, and he was in the Second World War.
Right.
I'm finding out hastily in Wikipedia. So, and he liked sailing.
Yeah.
So his experience...
Was he in the Navy?
He wasn't in the Navy. There is a kind of a spy subplot. It's not just the Rusty Crowe character. In the books, it's Rusty Crowe and the Bettany character. The Doctor character is also a spy.
Oh.
Yeah.
So it's like a Sherlock and Watson sort of thing. It's like they're a duo.
Yeah. Well, you know, by the end, that's what there's the lovely bit at the end. That's a fantastic bit at the end where they're both playing musical instruments together and you get a sense of their relationship. Crowe and Bettany.
Crowe,
Cameron. The film would benefit far more if there was just more of them together. And more of that, but the
world would benefit if they just played their music. I mean, they're absolutely out of this world musicians. They are. Some of the songs that they are playing, themselves. And I have to say, very impressed by the performances there, because whilst they obviously weren't playing the music, they were doing a terrific job of scale movement to show that they were. Do you know what I mean? They'd rehearsed the movements to the extent where it was believable for the scenes where you could see their full body that they were doing something akin to the music.
One of the bits in the Wikipedia is titled "Media Exposure and Controversy in His Final Years."
Oh no! What did he do, O'Brien? He wasn't a pedo, was he?
He was a private guy. Blah blah blah.
That reminds me of the scene in Closer when Jude Law is explaining to Natalie Portman how he does his job as an obituaries writer, and he says stuff like, you know, he was an extravagant chap means that he was gay, or he was a private guy means that he was a paedophile.
Let's not throw around the P word at poor Patrick O'Brien yet.
No, I'm not saying Patrick O'Brien is a paedophile. I was saying that that sounds like the kind of thing that would mean. What did Patrick O'Brien do?
Patrick can be a bit of a snob socially and intellectually, someone said.
Right. I mean, that sounds like me. And you.
It just says there's a portrait of a man who is cold, bullying, isolated, snobbish, and super sensitive. The idea that should be called, that's titled under the title Controversy. It's like, fucking hell.
He was a snob. He was sensitive. I mean, I think we can both relate.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just to clear up, he wasn't, as far as we know, a paedophile.
Not according to Wikipedia.
He is dead, though, right?
Oh, yeah, he's dead. I mean, do we want to get, like, he was in the war, he wrote, and then he got massively into sailing and wrote these books. Does a work of art have to then, at the time, like, does it have to encapsulate everything? Oh, it doesn't talk about colonialism or interrogate the war. No.
Hey, man, you've slightly misinterpreted what I said, and or I misspoke slightly, and this is the second time you've tried to grapple with it. Not your bad. I'm just expressing. I don't believe that books of these times were. I don't want to apply the rules of today to historical works of the past. What I meant was really more about whether or not it was sort of very, very pro-military, or it was a kind of gateway drug for new militarians. Is that a word? Militarians?
I mean, even if it was, does it fucking matter?
I don't know. I think it does. I think it's interesting. These sorts of books, these kind of stories play a big role in people's desire to join the military. I think, for example, something that many people are looking for when they join the military is a bit of purpose and meaning. And films like this of the time, you know, I think this is why it's interesting. It was made, you say, released in 2003, right?
It opens with a kid getting his arm blown off.
Yeah.
So who's signing up? Oh, yeah, war's a load of fun. Navy looks like a laugh. It's not an advert for the Royal Navy.
I'm not saying it's an advert for the Royal Navy. Don't put words in my mouth.
I wouldn't dream of doing that.
You absolutely would. If I was asleep with my mouth open, you'd shove as many words in there as you could fit, my friend.
I'd put some milk toast in your mouth.
Anyway, what I'm trying to say...
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is Oh, I don't know what.
The thing is, I know what you're trying to say, and yeah. I'm being an absolute arsehole, and I'm deliberately manipulating.
There's a
and
scene in the film
that.
where they talk about England, you know, where they talk about what the values of England are, and I know that the film is just showing that these characters exhibit the belief in these values. I'm not saying that the film itself is trying to impart these values, but those are the reasons why people. Would happily join the military in the past, because there was an association, like a country in theory had values, like a company does. You know, we laugh at the idea that modern corporations have these values, that they believe in. A corporation believes in free speech for all. A corporation believes in, like, equality and fairness and good treatment of people and, you know, fair trade and all of these things, or whatever, as if it means anything. Like, countries... You know, I suppose, like, in the part in a simpler time,
well, they used to have that. You know,
they argued that they had that, right? In reality, they didn't have that. In reality, they had, like, exceptional propaganda for people in order to join the military and feel good about it. And that's what I'm interested in, because I do think there's the whole history of the first part of the 20th century is basically shrouded in, wrapped in domestic, in every country, domestic propaganda about two world war efforts. It's basically impossible to divorce modern history from those sorts of stories and those sorts of messages. It's everywhere. Like, the most famous image of the 20th century in Britain is the image of the working woman with the bandana on and her arm raised to show her bicep and get to work, we need you, we're relying on you. You know, like, these sorts of images, they're the most famous and visceral of the century. And almost all of the way that we understand ourselves, and particularly in the way that the film was used for this purpose, intentionally as well as unintentionally, it makes it really impossible to divorce it from those, the warping of values like that. And so whenever I, you know, whenever I read or watch something about war that was written somewhere during that time, I do question the purpose of it, or the values that it purports to have, or indeed the values that the warped values that it is, that it unintentionally carries because of the impact on the person who did write it. Because so much of that stuff is just fucking bullshit, right? So much of it is just, like, either intentionally or otherwise designed to make people feel good about joining a war effort to fight on the side of good against evil, and to go and put themselves in positions where any rational person that wasn't motivated by emotion wouldn't go.
Yeah, but I think any war film post any of the Vietnam War films, you can't lump that in. And like with this,
yeah,
it doesn't. What I do think is interesting is you watch this and you just accept British guys goodies, French guys baddies,
yeah.
And there's no talk about why they're in a war. I don't know who fucking Nelson is. I don't know what they're talking about,
because they are at war forever.
They are just at war, yeah. And then they must beat the French. And I'm like, well, why?
Yeah. Yeah.
What if Napoleon wins this?
Well, they joke about that in the film, don't they?
Do they?
There's one joke where they say, if you're unlucky, Napoleon will win this thing, and you'll be at home eating frogs and dancing to French music or something.
Yeah, and then, you know, that would have been fine. But aside from that, you know, you're a very, sharp-minded guy. Mm-hmm. Okay, you've seen all these movies, and I bet you put yourself aside, and you wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't affect your psyche. The idea
is...
War films.
Oh, 100% do. They get right... I'm so susceptible to...
Is this why you're angry? Because I watched films, and when I was growing up, I was always wound up by the anti-violent movie agenda.
Right.
No one was talking about war movies or sexism. They were just like...
They hated Quentin Tarantino, and therefore you...
Yeah, and I was like, chill out, guys. Yeah. Violent movies don't make violent people. They honestly, in the 90s, though, it was an obsession.
Yeah, yeah, chill out, guys. It's okay that they try to rape the gimp guy in the cellar, you know?
I didn't believe that art had that power over people. because certainly over me, and like, to think that it would means that you think you're better than the proles. They can be manipulated.
Right, right, right.
And now I go, if you watch Top Gun, oh, Top Gun is so militaristic. Yeah, but it's a fucking movie. It's a fantasy. It's just this, I just don't buy it. I have got no problem with this dumb fantasy of like, you know, all movies, all stories, it's all a fantasy. It's all a lie. And it's just in that moment makes you feel better. Unfortunately, they do perpetuate certain stereotypes and attitudes, and then over time though they loosen and change,
yeah.
And the films change and the stories change. They don't create these things, they reflect.
I got two things, you're gonna love it. I got two things for you. Okay.
Hit me.
It could be more. Thing number one, okay, it's not so much like the storyline of the film or the surface level beats of the film, it's the values that the film expounds. That's it, right? It's not that it's about war or that it's set in war, that it's anything like that. For me, it is, and the thing I'm susceptible to is that there are two main messages to men in films. Yeah. One of them is get out there, you sexy guy, go and have sex with stuff. Right. That's one.
Yeah.
Two is you better goddamn do your duty, because that's what you're here for. And if you don't do that, then you're fucking nothing and you deserve to be dead. But before you're dead, we're gonna hang, draw and quarter you, and then we're gonna write vicious messages about you and your blood all over the roads near your house. You know, that's message number two.
That's number two is your favorite movie of all time, Gladiator.
Yeah, I know, of course. Okay, great. But this is what I'm saying. I'm very, very susceptible that message. I grew up as a man. I'm a man. I'm a man. I grew up in the 90s and the 2000s as a man. I'm a modern man. You know, I'm a modern man. I'm a man. But do I believe it's my responsibility to protect the non-men in my family or my immediate vicinity? Absolutely, I do. Do I think rationally that that is true any more so than it is my wife's responsibility to protect me? Rationally, I don't think that. Do I think that deep down? Do I believe that emotionally? I 100% believe that emotionally, because I grew up believing in these expounded values that were taught to me by society immediately around me, but were reinforced by, and still are, by every film that I see. Rusty Crow is the hero. Hey. Rusty Crow is the hero of Master and Commando, right? He's the hero. He's a man. He believes in himself. He has both the power to rise above his station as a man and take more and do something that was considered impossible and extraordinary through smartness and guile and cleverness and power and boldness and bravery. He also has the capacity to pause, to put pause on his selfish desires in order to do his duty to his other friends. And in this case, they are men, but they're lesser men than him. He has a responsibility to them as a leader of these people, right? He is a man that lives and breathes and abides his duty. And when you watch English films as an English person, that duty is directly related to Englishness. That's what happens in these films. It will happen in German films about German wars and German films. It will happen in American films about American people. It's not specifically national. It is made national by the messages of these films, that duty, your ultimate responsibility as a man to the people around you, is attached to a national sense of identity, and therefore you feel a national duty. That's thing number one.
Okay, let me put, okay, that's your thing. My pushback on that would be, I agree, but then I watched and I get all that. Like, I rewatched a Michael Mann movie called Thief.
Yeah.
Made in 1981. I realized when I watched it, Michael Mann movies are fantasies. I remember when you were like going, oh, just because the movie's violent doesn't mean it's for grown-ups. Michael Mann movies, and Thief in particular, is a fantasy. It speaks to this dream, and it's about a man who will not bend. He will not bend. He will only break.
Right.
And just try and break him. And it's about a thief. He's a safecracker. And by the end of the movie, James Caan, it's a fantastic flick. He's got this possibility of like finding love. He's got a wife. He's found a wife. He's got a kid. He's slightly compromised on his values to do that. And then it all comes tumbling down as it does. And he will not compromise himself any further. And so he has to ship his wife off and his kid. He'd rather do that and then burn down his house, blow his house up, burn down his job and destroy everything than compromise or change who he is deep down, which is he will not be told what to do. He's not going to be in anyone's pocket. And I was watching it and I just thought, oh man, I'd love to pack my wife and kids off and it blow up my house and burn down my job and fucking go off and kill all my enemies.
Yeah.
And just be, and I'm not going to bend anymore. Go on, fucking break me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is fantasy. This is this masculine schoolboy fantasy of, and it really appealed to me. I'm not actually going to do that.
It's
base
level.
Yeah. It's
primordial.
And it speaks to me, and then that's great. But it's not selling me a dream. It's a way for me to exercise that horrible little feeling, that horrible little nub. Well, to get rid of that nub.
Sure, sure.
Okay, and like in the same way that you watch a horror movie to exercise some kind of fear, movies, you know, they take away these feelings.
Sure.
I don't think they stoke them.
No, but that film isn't attaching that feeling to a campaign or movement. That's the difference, right? Like that's that feeling that you're describing is a desire ultimately for status and for security, right? It's the desire to be able to do what you want to whom whenever you want because you have the power to do it and to not have that done unto you, right? That's ultimately like a desire for status and power and with which comes security and safety. And if the film was saying that the way for the character to do that would be to join the military and then realize those dreams, then that's kind of attaching it to a real life sort of campaign or message that might confuse people, you know. Whereas in your film, it is just a fantasy with characters who aren't attached to wider groups.
Well, it attaches it to violence.
It attaches to violence, sure, but like violence isn't a campaign or movement. Violence is just a byproduct of campaigns and movements.
So what's your point? Okay, I like it. Well, so what point two?
Recently I found out that two people I know who I would consider very intelligent voted for a political party in the UK that I could never imagine that anyone I know would vote for, and believe various things that I could imagine no intelligent person would believe, which goes to further prove the point, if proof be need be at this point, that susceptibility is not about intelligence. Susceptibility is an emotional affair.
Yeah, no, I get that. I'm a deeply arrogant person who believes that I live above all of this.
What was it that they said in the controversy section of O'Brien's Wikipedia? He was a snob.
I'm a fucking snob. But also because then it makes me think I can't imagine, you know, that anyone else would be affected by stuff.
Fucking idiots.
Let's do the box office, baby. Let's get these numbers going.
Well, this is, as you'll remember, for the film Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, which, as you've said numerous times already, was released in 2003. Now, I think you know they probably spent a lot on this. Let me give you a little bit of extra information, though.
I don't need extra information.
Well, no, how about just one little bit? You will already know this because you're such a smart, smart guy and character you are, but I was watching the film and wondering, oh, I wonder if they really are filming on the Galapagos Islands. The answer, they were. Budget brackets estimated, please.
I mean, water movies notoriously cost a fuckload.
They're expensive, right? Water movies.
You got Cutthroat Island, fuckload. Waterworld, fuckload. You know, water tanks.
Fuck
the load. Abyss, mate. The Abyss.
Oh,
remember
the Abyss.
I remember
the Abyss.
You've got the ships on the water, and then you've got the inside a tank, and then, you know, when you've got people with buckets throwing the thing over.
Oh, those people with buckets are expensive. The union people with buckets, very expensive.
I just, you're watching it, you're just thinking all this money's getting spent, and I just think I could give less of a fuck about all this money being spent to see a ship getting battered by water. It's the least interesting thing I think I can ever see. Like, even when the cannons are going, I don't know. Am I wrong? It's just boring cinematically. I couldn't give a fuck. Do you like it?
I tell you this, okay? I played the game Assassin's Creed Black Flag.
Mm, me too.
Do you remember that at the four corners of the map, there were these legendary ships that you would fight, and you on your little vessel that you would level up over time. Initially you'd head over there at the early game. You'd go, whoa, now Nelly, can't go there. That's for later in the game, right? And then over time you work up the confidence and the resources, and you go back and you give it a try, and you end up like speeding round in a circle, just trying to shoot at it, just, you know, trying to avoid all the hits and trying to hit at the same time, working out your tactic. That's fun. That's like that. When that happened in that game, I was like, wow, okay, ship fighting is fun. I will agree with you. I've never felt it from watching it in a film. I've never felt it from seeing it in the cinema. I felt it playing it in a video game. Maybe it's something it needs to be more of an active experience, you know?
It's just because it's chaos. It goes back to the huge Forgot You Forgot, The Perfect Storm with George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg. It's just, it's dark and there's water sloshing in actors' faces and they're just shouting.
Yeah.
And they're going, turn right.
And there's no landmarks for anything, right? Like, it's not like Rusty Crowe is fighting in a circle of tigers where, you know, if you go too far this way, there's tigers, too far this way, there's tigers. At the sea, you're just at sea. There's nothing anywhere. It's just all water everywhere. So you could be anywhere. You could be any distance from each other. It's long distance in some instances. You're right. It is boring. Yeah.
Although it's still better than Gladiator. So a lot of money's been spent at over 100 mil. Let's say 160 mil.
Oh, very close. 150 mil. Inside the 10%. Inside the 10%.
Oh, it's been a while since you said the
Well, it's been a while since you've been inside the 10%. You know. Hey, if you want me to say it, you got to try harder in the game. That's all I can say.
I'm always trying hard, mate.
I know. We haven't played it for a while because we haven't done that many canonical episodes, you know. Yeah. Anyway, it's a good start. It's a good start. What about this? Opening weekend, US and Canada, November the 16th, 2003. What do you think a little old movie like this takes? In the wake of Gladiator, of course.
I think initially it'll get bums on seats. Maybe. You know, they're going to market the fuck out of it.
Yeah, they are.
Rusty. I mean, if this doesn't get Jumper money, you know, Jumper, piece of shit Jumper gets 25 mil.
27 mil.
Shut up. I don't know that.
That's
okay?
What Jumper money. You said,
I know,
25.
But I don't know. I don't know.
You always do this about Jumper.
Because if I know this, I don't know. If I hold on to these numbers lit like as if they matter.
Mm.
Then I lose.
Then you believe in the power of the game. Come on.
It's near Christmas. It needs to get a decent run. It's not going to do Logan. Let's say it gets 35.
Oh, you're outside the 10%. You were on the money with your version of Jumper. It was $25,105,990.
As soon as I thought of the budget, I thought, well, maybe it would squeeze an extra 10. No, I'll take it.
Sadly,
I was circling.
Well, there's nothing to take, so you won't take it.
But, yeah, but like, I'm taking it.
Well, but the thing is, you can't take it because there's nothing to take. There's the table's empty, my friend. You know,
there is, because I said 25. I knew the ballpark, and then I swung for the fences. So I'm taking it.
Okay, fine. Right, gross worldwide.
Now, I don't think this is a what they call flop.
A flop arena.
I think it's an underperformer. Big
interesting. Underperformer? Sounds like using
difference.
The 10x rule a little bit there.
No.
What's it underperforming?
Based on Hollywood expectations.
The 10x rule. Yeah, got it.
No,
got it.
That's not... The 10x rule isn't anything to do with Hollywood.
That's how they work it out.
Ring up Hollywood and they'll go, what the fuck? I mean, it's not... I don't think it's... I just work on the budget is 150.
They've
spent 50 at least on marketing. So it's, they've sunk 200 million and they'll want to make 400 back. If they hit 10x, this film technically shouldn't hit its 10x because it's a disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of needs to. I don't think it doesn't get talked about as one of the flopperinos of the time. So I think maybe it hits bang on 250 mil.
Sadly, no. It takes 211 mil.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, I said two. So, yeah, I mean, it's it's underperformed the 10x rule. Yeah. Here we go. No. Now, given Joe's travails, struggling to see the flick No Brother, Where Art Thou, we're going to power on ahead and we want to play pure movies you forgot, you forgot. Of course we're going to get to No Brother, Where Art Thou. I've already watched it. But we need to get back onto canon episodes.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I got you on No Brother, Where Art Thou.
Uh-huh.
I've missed you saying films and trying to catch me out. It's mm-hmm. been a million years. Uh-huh. Please, 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 please. Uh-huh. Can we do the segment of the show where you try and catch me out on a movie I forgot? Can we?
Let's do it. Okay. I'm just adjusting my list, though, because I haven't opened this for a while, and it's full of war movies. Christ. And we just had a very
wary.
A little bit of a wary chat, and I worry that we'll have a wary time if we do a war film. So let me just adjust on the fly. Right, okay. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Where the Wild Things Are.
This is good.
Is it plum?
It's not plum. It's partial plum because...
Partial plum?
Because I have that book in my house.
Oh, no.
It's not on my shelf.
Where is it?
It's in my son's pile of books.
Right.
And it hasn't been in rotation for quite some time. This is a golden duck, though. I'm going to give you golden duck. But
okay.
And then it's appeared. It appeared and I thought... Oh, we were doing her. Spike Jonze. Who the fuck remembers Where the Wild Things Are? What was that movie? Was it any good? I remember seeing it. I was living in Hackney. It's a million years ago.
James Gandolfini voices one of the characters, right? That's the only thing I remember about it.
I remember Catherine Keener's the mum. I remember, just like her, there was quite the long production story that went along with it, because
right.
people, this is such a beloved kids book.
Yeah,
the idea that he was making it, people were so pumped, and I think they went down to Australia maybe, and they were filming for fucking ages.
So this is another Spike Jonze movie.
This is a Spike Jonze flick.
Oh, I didn't know that. So we're almost back to backing Spike Jonze.
We're back to backing, and also the script was written by. This guy's a forgot. Dave Eggers. Do you remember Dave Eggers?
Eggers? Isn't Robert Eggers a movie director?
Yeah, no, that's Robert. This is Dave Eggers.
Are they not related?
There are two different men
with the surname Eggers, and they're not related.
Dave Eggers was, in the 2000s, was everywhere.
Really?
All over Eggers. If you were a hipster in New York or... L.A. or
Hackney,
you know, you'd know the name Dave Eggers.
Right.
Eggers.
Wonder if anyone ever called him Deggers. Can we call him Deggers?
We can call him Deggers. I mean, he wrote the screenplay for that Sam Mendes flick, Away We Go.
Oh, Mendes Nuts.
Mendes Nuts. I would love to. We're not going to, but Dave Eggers. Yeah, there you go. Can I
say something maybe my proudest achievement on this podcast is, I remember the first maybe seven times I said Mendes Nuts and you just didn't, you were not on board with it at all. Whereas now when I say Mendes Nuts, you just repeat Mendes Nuts back to me and we have a lovely time saying it, you know?
Yeah, I hate it. I don't know why, but
do you?
I mean, I... Yeah, but in the same way that you hate my VPN joke.
Oh, God.